Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast. And a warm welcome to the show. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and nobody has to know what day it is because everybody knows it's July 5th. After a big July 4th holiday, it's kind of, I don't know, it seems to punctuate summer. For me, that's the midway point. Now it's like, oh boy, now the second half of the summer has officially begun. And before you know it, we're going to be seeing ads in the paper for back to school clothes, which I like to go buy every year anyway. I used to love going and buying school supplies. Who doesn't love buying brand new pencils and erasers and notebooks? I tell you, that's exciting, even for me at my age. Anyway, we have a great hour coming up. Brett Hagler is already on our studio line. We're going to bring him on in just a minute. He is one of the most impressive guys that I have not met in person, but I sure would like to. He's the CEO and co-founder of New Story. It's a nonprofit that builds safe, thriving communities in the developing world. And he's got quite a story. We're going to bring him on in just a minute. And then Pastor Scott Sauls from Christ Presbyterian Church in Nashville is going to be our guest. And he's a regular contributor on the show, and I always look forward to Scott and his wisdom. So that's what's going on today. We're going to take a little break and then bring on Brett.
Pray Together Sunday is a simple opportunity for churches to join with congregations across America to ask God for spiritual renewal in our country. Ask your church to join us for Pray Together Sunday on July 8th and commit to a time of prayer for our country during your church's Sunday worship service. Together, we will lift our voices on behalf of our communities and nation. Register and find resources for your church at nae.net/praytogether. Pray Together Sunday on July 8th is organized by the National Association of Evangelicals, where we use influence for good.
See, we were not gone long. We're already back. It's 6 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here. I'm talking to Brett Hagler. He's on our studio line. He is CEO and co-founder of New Story. It's a nonprofit that builds safe, thriving communities in the developing world. He is a cancer survivor. He's an author. He's a speaker. In Forbes magazine in 2016, he was part of the 30 Under 30 Entrepreneurs, which is a pretty nice distinction. And after kind of reviving a lost Christian faith and making a 180 in his life, he took a trip to Haiti and met some families living in kind of the slums. And New Story began. And I'm realizing that if I was young, good-looking, and ambitious, I'd be him. Hey, Brett, how are you?
Quite the intro. Thank you, Bill. Great to be on.
You're welcome. Now, I saw what's happening in your new ambitious project to do 3D printing of homes, and I had to laugh because how much ink does that take?
how much ink? It's a concrete ink that we've created, and kind of have this new proprietary mix where I'm not sure if any of your listeners have seen the video, but you could Google it. Type in New Story 3D home printer. Mm-hmm. And essentially if people are familiar with 3D printing, it's that, but a little bit bigger. And there is cement, oozing out of kind of like a hose, like mm-hmm. nozzle, basically mm-hmm. to think of, or almost kind of like what comes out of like an ice cream machine.
Yeah.
Now it kind of oozes out. So, but that's cement that's coming out of there. And then it's layering a CAD file. The machine is layering that CAD file with the cement. And then, so that's our latest R&D innovation project. We're very proud to have designed the first 3D home printer that's specifically built for the developing world and mm-hmm. for families that are in the most need. And then we have successfully printed our first pilot home in Austin, Texas, which passed the Austin City Housing Code. So like literally anybody could go live there right now. It's a real house. It isn't just, you know, something in a lab that we cooked up. We've proven it. And then the next step, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is actually printing the first community of homes in El Salvador within the next 10 months.
See, Brett, this is so exciting. Now, first of all, is the machine called the Vulcan? Do I have that right?
Yes.
Now,
that's right.
You can design to print a home for less than $4,000 and do that in less than 24 hours. That's a major major breakthrough, isn't it?
Yeah, and then you have those are the two obvious ones. But in the third big component of it, which I think sometimes gets overlooked, is that you can do those things of one, significantly cutting costs, but then and two, bringing down the time to build from those 15 days to 24 hours, which is obviously a huge difference. You can do those two things without sacrificing quality, mm-hmm. but actually improving quality. So making the home stronger, more durable, better compression, and then being able to have different designs because if you think of almost like it being plugged into a computer that has a CAD file, you can change through different CAD files and based on the family's needs. So we'll have many, many, many different designs. So you're also delivering a better product to the families.
Mm-hmm. Now, Brett, you've been at this for a while, building homes and creating communities. How many homes have you built already before the 3D printer has come into play?
We've done now close to 1,400.
Okay.
And those homes are not—they're not one-off. All of them comprise a community. And so we build, this is kind of what New Story does, is we get a large piece of land. We work with excellent local nonprofit partners. Most of them are Christian organizations. And then we will design and develop a holistic community with the families that will be living in there. So we'll get, we'll of course do the housing to start. We believe that's critical as a foundation because if you're just living in a tent or you don't have anything, it's really hard to get to the next step that you want to get to without sustainable shelter and safety.
Mm-hmm.
So we design a community of about 100 to 400 home community.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will bring on partners to join our community for components like a school, a community church, clean water solutions in the area, micro loans and agriculture training, where the end product is a holistic community, not just a house here or a house there.
Mm-hmm. And prior to the idea of the 3D printer, it would take approximately 15 days to build a home. Does that sound about right?
Correct.
Now,
yeah, on average, it's about 15 days. Yes, sir.
And right. What I love about what you're doing is you're not just doing the one-off house. You are actually building communities where people live and thrive and raise their families and go to school and enjoy communal living and activities, which is so sustainable and it's so smart. And now you've got this possible Vulcan 3D printer that can change your speed from 15 days to 12 to 24 hours to build a home. It's just crazy.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think if you don't mind me sharing a bit of, you know, why are we doing this? And because this is still to be proven,
right?
Like we've done a great job of, we invested money, we created the machine with a robotic construction company called Icon, and we successfully printed the first house. That house turned out probably better than anybody thought, and that's what got a lot of attention. We got about close to 150 million video views around the world, and close to a billion impressions. And so the word got out. God gave us this platform. And what we now have to do is we have successfully print the first community of about 100 homes in El Salvador. And that's what we're on track to do within the next 10 months. But all to say, Bill, the reason why we're investing into this, and I get asked this a lot, like, why does New Story believe in innovation and R&D? Like, you guys are a nonprofit, just go raise more money to build houses. But the reason why is because if innovation actually works, as we're starting to get a glimpse of with the 3D home printing, then the short answer is we can impact more lives exponentially faster and better. Mm. So when we actually look at the risk of, okay, maybe this fails and yes, we lose some money, but it was responsible and wouldn't sink the company. Worst case scenario, that's it. Best case scenario, we innovate shelter for the poor. And so that's why we're doing this, right? And it's something that I'm very passionate about as an entrepreneur is I think that we need much more calculated risk-taking and R&D and innovation when we're working on some of the biggest problems in the world. That's a little bit of my passion for it.
Yeah, but big problems, big issues, big solutions, and you've created one in your brain, and you've got this big challenge ahead of you, but there are more than a billion people living across the globe right now that are doing so without any kind of safe shelter. Something like this could radically change the speed at which people go from living without shelter to living with shelter.
Correct. Yeah, we're just trying to put a dent in it, the biggest dent we can. And to do that, we have to get the cost lower. I mean, one of the things with shelter is that that's different than a lot of other basic needs, right? Water, food. Water, food, it's a much lower cost delivery, right? Mm-hmm. So to get a well into a community, you know, the price ranges, but it's anywhere from, you know, $10,000 to call it even $50,000, mm-hmm. right? Well, one house, you know, is going to be usually at least $5,000 to $10,000. That's for one family, mm-hmm. right? So the cost is so high when you say there's a billion people that need that. We believe that by trying to slash the cost nearly in half without sacrificing quality is a way that we can, try to get a bigger dent in that number faster.
Mm-hmm. Brad, if you had 150 million views, I think you're getting some attention.
It was much bigger than we expected.
Yeah.
Look, the reality is it's a great shiny object, right? I'm the one to say that. It's sexy. It's for innovation. It's for social. So we knew that there was going to be, you know, attention, but the amount we've gotten, is probably about 100 times larger than we thought. And I just remember, every single morning leading up to this, just, you know, praying and saying, if this is in your will, please give us a platform and have this go around the world. And for whatever reason, you know, it seems like that prayer was granted.
Wow, that's fantastic. Brett, let me take a short break. When we come back, more with Brett Hagler.
Sure.
It is 17 minutes after the hour. We'll be right back. If you just joined us, you're going to want to go back and hear the entirety of this message. I'm having a very interesting conversation with Brett Hagler. He's the CEO and co-founder of New Story. It's a nonprofit that builds thriving communities in the developing world. Notice I just didn't say houses. I said communities, which is what I love about his thinking. And you're certainly thinking smarter, not just harder, which I love. And Brad, I'd be curious, and I know our listeners would love to hear a little bit of your backstory. I know you survived cancer, and you had an experience in Haiti that sort of was a big wake-up call, and it sort of renewed your faith. Would you share some of that story?
Yeah, I would be honored to. So I'll give you all the super short version. Grew up basically in and out of the church, went to a private Christian middle school and high school. And during that time, I just kind of thought that I was too cool for it. I thought that, you know, there was too many rules, that you couldn't have fun, and all these wrong things. And I just kind of said, I'm going to figure this out when I'm like 60 or 70, or maybe just try to time it really well and figure it out like a week before I die. that was my plan.
Yeah.
And so I then went and pursued what I call the 3 G's. And it wasn't God, generosity, and gratitude. It was girls, gold, and glory, the 3 G's. And that is what I pursued from about age 16 to about age 23. And that was my God. And when I got out of college, I had always been very, very, very ambitious and very entrepreneurial. And so I always thought that I would use that to start companies and make a ton of money. But then when I got out of college, I was fundraising for a for-profit company that I was starting. We were raising venture capital. And one of the folks that I wanted to be an investor, I met him for lunch. And at lunch, this is a guy that I already looked up to so much for what he had accomplished and just how he carried himself and everything I knew. He was like my role model. I had no idea that he was a believer. And basically at lunch, he just kind of very casually, not pushy, not weird, just shared his faith with me and shared that, like, you know, I was asking him leadership questions of, and he would answer with things like servant leadership and this and that. And I'd be like, why? And he'd be like, well, you know, I really believe in Jesus' philosophy. So anyways, that was a spark that kind of shattered the objections that I had growing up. And I think for people listening, like, that it's really cool to think that you can make such an impact on one person's life. Where after that lunch, he then told me to go to a great church in the Atlanta area, North Point Church, pastored by Andy Stanley. Mm-hmm. And so I started going there, and fast forward about a year, and I just like said, hey, I'm totally in, like, full surrender, got baptized, and then went on a trip to Haiti shortly after that. I was actually going for the for-profit company that I had at the time, and we were going to give back some of the money we were making to a charity. And then when I got down there, that's when I saw the issue of, at that time, over hundreds of thousands of people that were still living in temporary tarp tents. Mm. Almost 4 years after the earthquake.
Wow.
And as of today, I've been working on this one project. You know, there's still close to 80,000 people in Haiti, almost 9 years after the earthquake, that are living in tarp tents that were supposed to last for 3 to 4 months. So we're now doing actually a really big new community in Haiti. And it's an area called Titayan, which I would love to share because I'm very passionate about this community. Titayan is actually translated, that means less than nothing. It got that name because after the earthquake, it was an area where bodies were dumped, and it was a graveyard because nobody could afford funerals, and they just dumped people in this area. And it's really been known as kind of the poorest, worst area outside of Port-au-Prince in Haiti. And we're now coming in with an amazing local partner in Haiti called Mission of Hope, great Christian organization. And we're building about a 300-home, beautiful community in this area. And so that's what, you know, I'm now focused on with our current project.
That's amazing. So if listeners want to go look at the picture of what you're doing, yeah, and how these communities look, which, by the way, are spectacular. I mean, this is really beautiful work that you're doing, and it's so impressive. Let them know the website they can go to.
Yeah, you can do newstorycharity.org, or if you just Google, like, new story homes or communities, will pop up. Mm-hmm. Pretty easy to find.
Yeah, and Brett, I do.
And then if you want to see the 3D home printer, we have a little short URL. It's 3dhome.org.
Okay.
Or you can just Google new story 3D home printer. It'll, mm-hmm, pop up.
Yeah. Now, I would love for you to share with our listeners. This would be very encouraging because I know that you're an entrepreneur, but you're also, mm-hmm, a guy that is not afraid of hard work.
Yeah.
And right. And I think you had shared a tweet that Kobe Bryant gave, which I thought was really strong.
Oh, yeah.
Really strong. And maybe you could share share that with our listeners just as a way of encouraging them.
Yeah. You know, and I'm obviously there's a balance to it, but I would say, like, the one, so God has given me some gifts that I don't have. Like, I'm definitely not the smartest guy. I definitely don't have the most talent in a lot of areas. But what Kobe Bryant said that I've kind of used as a motto is, he was basically receiving an award at the ESPYs. It was an icon award. So they were giving out icon awards to him, Peyton Manning, et cetera. And what Kobe Bryant said was, you know, we're not up on this stage because of something that, you know, some ability that we were given. He said, we're up here because of 4 a.m. And what he was referring to is that, you know, Kobe was the one that was getting up before everybody else, the rookies, whoever it is, and he was, his work ethic and his self-discipline, that was the reason why he became an icon. It wasn't the fact that, you know, obviously he had great talent, right? But there are other people that have had great talent. And I think as an entrepreneur, you can take that same mindset. What I love about that is it doesn't matter your IQ. It doesn't matter what you were given, what you weren't given, because we can all make choices to have that daily self-discipline to whatever you're trying to do, whether it's writing your book or starting your podcast or getting your first 100 blog subscribers or, you know, preaching your message, whatever it is, we can put in that disciplined daily work. And I think that's what I've done. Most of my team members would say that's, you know, one of my top strengths. And it's probably one of the number one reasons why we've been able to get off to a pretty decent start.
Mm-hmm. And people would say, if you're doing all that, Brett, you're not normal.
Right.
They would say you're a little obsessed.
Yeah. You know, and again, there's a balance to it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right, the position that I'm in right now, I'm not married. I don't have kids. I'm 28. So obviously when the family comes, that changes things. And then, you know, another good thing that I've learned is that, this is tough, and I don't think anybody has the clearest answer. It's like, yes, on one hand, you absolutely should, in my opinion, be obsessed over something, and not be normal about it, but be extraordinary for it. But at the same time, as believers, we obviously can't make that our number one idol. And we can't do that if we're losing out intimacy with Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another big learning I've had in the last year, is that, you know, spectacular results and spectacular impact really means, I don't want to say nothing, but doesn't mean much if we're not at the same time growing our relationship with Christ. And so I think as a young entrepreneur that has, you know, is prone to want to work insanely hard and be very, all of these things, you can never lose sight of that. And that's a big learning I've had in the last year.
Yeah. Well, Brett, I got to say, you're just a big inspiration. And ever since I was introduced to you, I've been inspired, and I think you're doing amazing work, and God's done some great work through you and your team. So just loved having you on the show. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Bill.
You
God
bet.
Bless. Take God, care, guys.
God bless.
Cheers.
Thanks
Bye.
So much. It's 28 minutes after the hour. We'll take a little break. Coming up next, Pastor Scott Sauls will be with us. Be back in just a minute. Minutes after the hour, welcome back to the show. Bill Arnold here with you. You will be happy to get to know Scott Sauls. I encourage you to get to know him, because you will be a much happier person. I always appreciate him being calm and rational and reasonable, but he's also so biblically sound and vulnerable that I always look forward to having him on the show. He is the senior pastor at Christ Presbyterian Church in Nashville. He moved from New York City to serve as a senior pastor there. He worked under the leadership of Dr. Tim Keller for 10 years at Redeemer, and he's now serving as senior pastor in Nashville. So, Scott, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me back.
Well, I love you. I love your ministry. I love the way you teach. I love your vulnerability. So there you go. I'm done gushing.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
I appreciate that.
That's enough gushing for one day.
Okay.
And you're killing it in your sermon series on Philippians. I've been listening to you, so that's been great. Oop, I might have lost you. I think we got a cell phone that went bad. Are you there?
Yes. I'm here. Can you hear me okay?
You did go silent for a little while, but you are back.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No problem.
I had a bad connection there.
Yeah.
Okay.
I was just saying how much I'm enjoying your sermon series on Philippians.
Oh, thank you for that. I appreciate that. It's been a fun study, challenging and just really enriching personally as well.
Yeah. And a recent blog caught my attention when you talked about feeling like a failure and the power of affirming words. I want to say that's something we could all stand to hear a little bit about this afternoon.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess that's a post that I put up on my blog, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, and you know, just described a little bit about how we do things on our staff. When we have our staff meetings, we try to start our meetings not tackling problems as much as just offering words of encouragement and blessing to one another and about the things that God's doing, you know, through the different members of the staff. And then I went in, I think, to a couple of situations where I felt like I'd blown it or felt like I wasn't fulfilling my calling well, and a couple of people in my life had, you know, spoken words of life, you know, into me in those situations. And so that's what that one's about. It's a pretty short essay, I think, but yeah, is that the one that you're wanting to talk about?
Yeah, it is, because I think all of us feel inadequate from time to time. All of us feel like we have failed from time to time. And then usually what we do is we pick up the largest stick we can find and start beating ourselves with it.
Yes. Well, we either start beating ourselves up or we start defending ourselves and pretending that we haven't fallen short of anything. And both of those are I guess, directions that we take that aren't ultimately healthy ways of dealing with our own shortcomings and struggle.
Mm-hmm. In the blog, Scott, you talked about some feelings you had. You were kind of feeling ashamed and maybe even grieved about some unkind things you had said about another person. And then all of a sudden, just this wave of, oh, what am I doing? I don't deserve to step into a pulpit and preach the words of God. And, you know, I just love your transparency. I love that you're so open about this stuff.
Well, yeah, that was a conversation, thankfully, that only one other person was part of rather than a whole group of people. And that was with my wife. We were out to dinner one night, and this was, I don't know, the Tuesday or Wednesday night before Easter. I don't know. I was expressing frustration with her or to her with somebody, with another person who wasn't there in the conversation, and just said some really uncharitable things about the person. And my wife just sort of calmly looked at me and said, Scott, you know, as much as you preach and teach and write about the toxic effects of gossip, that really was not a good thing that you just said to me. And I think that you probably know that. And kind of on the spot, I just felt this flood of discouragement about myself and how, you know, on the one hand, I can get up every week and preach the gospel from a pulpit to, you know, thousands of people, and then a couple days later I can be tearing somebody apart with my words behind their back, you know, just like the New Testament talks about, you know, blessing people with our mouths and also cursing them with mm-hmm. our mouths, blessing God with our mouths and cursing people with the same tongue, that, you know, this should not be so. And so I said to my wife, I said, my goodness, you know, do you think I'm a fraud? Because I certainly feel like one right now. Do you think I belong in ministry, or should I, you know, look for another career path? She said, I think that now is the time that you probably ought to believe the same things that you preach to the rest of us on a regular basis, that you are an incomplete work in process and God's not done with you yet and grace abounds, and that's the environment that God's given you in which to repent of what you've done. And, you know, and I think it wasn't insignificant that this was a few days before Easter Sunday, because pastors can, without basis, we can walk into our pulpits on Easter Sunday with a little bit more swag than we usually do.
Mm-hmm.
There's just, I guess, an extra level of confidence and possibly even cockiness that can come over us when, you know, you've got the biggest crowds of the year and those sorts of things. And, you know, I always tell, I tell our pastoral staff, the true test of how content we are in our ministry is not how we feel on Easter Sunday, but how we feel on July 4th weekend, you know, during the services when everybody's traveling and
right.
gone. But you know, I think that that might have been God's way of preparing me to walk into the pulpit on Easter with a limp instead of a swag, you know, with humility instead of, you know, an elevated sense of what I was doing. So, but yeah, I mean, I've over the years, I've had a lot of moments like that with my wife where she'll just faithfully, you know, challenge me and then, you know, in the same breath almost point me to the gospel. And, you know, I think it's important for people to realize that their preachers and pastors need the same grace ongoing that everybody else does. And, you know, and so I don't have a problem being transparent about that. Otherwise, I set my people up to put me on a pedestal that I don't belong on.
Yeah.
And I potentially set myself up for pride and a sense of importance, of self-importance and appropriate for the advancement of the gospel, because, you know, my ministry and my church is ultimately about Jesus, not about me. It's about people hearing his voice and not so much about them hearing my voice. And so... So that's my story and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, I like it. So when you get confronted by your wife, I mean, were you able to listen without being defensive?
Oh, in that instance, absolutely.
Oh, sweet.
I knew I was flat wrong and I think that gossip is one of the most horrible things that can happen in communities and especially in churches. Gossip is just a destroyer of communities of faith, of you know, confessing other people's sins to people who are not part of the solution and not part of the problem. You know, and I you know, I think a gossip is its own form of pornography in that it's a way to objectify another human being and get a cheap thrill from it without making any commitment to that person personally.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, there's a lot of similarities between gossip and pornography in those respects. And so, and they're both just killers of community. They increase loneliness and they don't accomplish anything fruitful. And so yeah, I, you know, on that one, you know, as strongly as I preach and teach against gossip, my wife, you know, she nailed it, and I was appreciative of that. And then, you know, there are other times where, you know, defensiveness will kick in, but not in that conversation.
Mm-hmm. So, Scott, as a pastor, you know what it's like to be obviously up preaching and teaching, and you know, when I host a radio show, certainly when you hear words of what appear or sound like failure or condemnation. Why do we hear those words so much clearer than we seem to hear affirmation?
Because of the Garden of Eden.
yeah.
Take a look at Adam and Eve and the psychology that we inherited from both of them.
Yeah.
After sin came into the world, what did they do? They heard the voice of God and they ran and they hid from him. They tried to cover themselves with fig leaves. They started shifting blame. You know, Eve blamed the serpent. Adam blamed the woman, and then Adam blamed God for giving him the woman. And you know, nobody was taking responsibility. And I think it's just how deeply shame impacts us. You know, Mariah Carey, the famous musician, at the peak of her career, you know, was asked by Barbara Walters in an interview what's the one thing that she has yet to achieve? And her answer was happiness. And Barbara Walters asked a follow-up question. What do you mean by that? How can you possibly say that with all of your number one hits and your fame and fortune and everything else? And she said, I can hear 1,000 praises and 1 word of criticism. And that 1 word of criticism will completely erase the 1,000 praises. And I think our hearts are just a lot more sensitive to the shame triggers than they are to the praise and affirmation triggers. We believe the shame, we believe the criticisms a lot more deeply than we believe the praises. Because I think deep down, each of us is carrying a sense of shame, carrying a sense of not being who we're supposed to be,
mm-hmm.
or what we're supposed to be, and we can put on masks and get defensive and put on a show and everything else, but ultimately, you know, all of us deep down, I mean, even those who are most prideful and most boastful, the pride and the boasting is. It typically comes from a place of deep insecurity, and you're compensating for trying to cover over something, you know, of a deep inadequacy of shame inside of ourselves, and that's why we need the gospel so much, because the gospel reverses all that. It reverses the negative verdicts and it reverses the shame, and declares that we're beloved, and that we're adored, that we're redeemed, restored, forgiven, and that God's got a glorious future for us, and all those wonderful gospel truths, which need to keep pounding into our minds and hearts.
Mm-hmm. Scott, do we sometimes take the negative comments too personal? Because really, what we want is we want to be liked. I want you to like me, and if you don't like me, how am I ever going to share the gospel with me if the baseline is you don't even like me?
Yeah, well, I think deep down that desire to be liked and applauded and recognized and appreciated is actually a God thing. We're created in the image of God. I mean, if you think about it, the whole purpose of God's existence is to receive glory and to receive honor and to receive praise. And if we're made in his image, of course we're going to value, recognition and admiration and so I would really not want to suggest that desiring to be liked or desiring to be loved is a bad thing. That's actually an expression of the image of God. It's when we do very distorted things and resort to very distorted, behaviors like gossip, like hiding, like lying and telling things that aren't true about ourselves and those sorts of things in order to be liked and in order to be appreciated, that's where we get into trouble and set ourselves up for some grief.
Mm-hmm. Scott, let me take a very short break. I'm speaking to Scott Sauls. He's written a book called Jesus Outside the Lines. He's written a book called Befriend, Create Belonging in an Age of Judgment, Isolation, and Fear. And he's also written a book called From Weakness to Strength, 8 vulnerabilities that can bring out the best in your leadership. We'll take a short break and be back with Scott Sauls in just a minute. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. Scott Sauls is my guest on our studio line. He is pastor of Christ Presbyterian Church in Nashville. He's an author and speaker, and just a favorite guest of mine. And Scott, let me ask you, when Christians really become different from the world, it seems that people are drawn to them. But are we doing that enough nowadays, and are we appearing different, and is it attractive?
Well, I think that the answer is yes and no.
Okay.
I think that the stories that get the most press and the most attention are the uglier stories of Christians being judgmental, Christians blundering this or that, and I think there's so much going on that doesn't get reported on, that doesn't get major public attention of things like orphan care, or things like Christians being on the front front lines for fighting against the sex trafficking industry, for Christians loving their neighbors extraordinarily well. And you know, I think those stories are all over the place everywhere. They're just kind of hidden under a bushel, and they don't get publicized as often as they ought to. But I think the story of Christianity around the world, and even in our part of the world, if you were able to see the whole story of what God's doing through people and through communities, it would be a much more bright and beautiful story than I think what often gets displayed, you know, in the public conversation. That's my opinion, and that's my observation. You know, it's the world I've lived in for you know, well over half of my life, and so that's my opinion.
Yeah.
That being said, I think Christians, we really do need to be very intentional about changing the public story,
mm-hmm.
By virtue of, you know, kind of putting aside this idea that's actually never worked in any part of the world. It's never been an effective way to advance Christianity to try to take control of governments and, you know, power structures, thinking that if we just got the right people in office, if we just, you know, gained power, you know, in this sector or that sector, then the world would become more Christian. Oftentimes, in fact, I think every time in church history I can think about it, both recently and in ancient church history, it's actually had the opposite effect. You know, Christianity started to lose its influence in Rome when Constantine, you know, the emperor, decided he wanted to turn Christianity into the state religion. We've seen the same thing happen in England, you know, over the years. And, you know, in some ways we see it happening in the aftermath of the, you know, sort of 80s and 90s moral majority movement, where, you know, you have these major voting blocks of evangelicals and, you know, getting people in all these different positions of power. And supposedly that's supposed to fix the moral ills of the world and unite people together. And it seems to have had the opposite effect. And now the younger generations are leaving the church and disenchanted by the, you know, conflation of faith and politics, you know, of their parents' generation. And so I think we need a new story, where Christians move out into the world not as a, you know, a power-driven moral majority, but as a love-driven, life-giving minority. You know, that's where Christianity has always flourished, when Christians were in the minority. We saw this in our New York City years, where it was, you know, less than 10% of New Yorkers identified as Christian, and where you did find Christians, you found a real, you know, on fire dynamic for the gospel. That you don't necessarily find in more nominal cultures like the Bible Belt.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, in some ways, the Midwest, you know, Midwestern expressions of Christianity can be a lot more nominal and cultural versus, you know, deeply spiritual and lay down your life for the Lord and love God and love your neighbor as yourself. So, anyway, it's kind of a mouthful.
Yeah, it is. I like it, though. What would you speculate is the reason that the unchurched are kind of moving away and not wanting to participate? And that doesn't mean that they're not spiritual. There's a lot of people that are committed to God that don't want to be involved in church. What's up with that?
I think it's the same thing. I think people have lost faith in the institution of the local church because of how so much of institutional Christianity has attached itself to political platforms that are not comprehensively Christian. You know, the Republican platform, while it has elements of Christianity in it, is not comprehensively Christian. And in fact, there are certain aspects of the platform that create tension with Christianity, and the same exact things could be said about a Democratic platform, for
mm-hmm.
example, where there's certain elements of Christian virtue embedded in the platform, but there are also some pretty significant tension points with Christianity within the Democratic platform as well, and nobody's willing to admit that, and nobody's willing, you know, as a Christian, to say, while I do identify with this party or that party, I also see some significant inconsistencies with with the gospel within the party that I'm part of, and I'm not on board with those parts of the party.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just don't see a whole lot of Christians doing that.
Yeah,
because you can't get votes that way. You can't keep your base that way. And so what you end up having is a lot of hypocrisy.
Yeah.
You know, you've got left-leaning Christians giving strong support to platforms that are, you know, not only in support of but aggressive about the abortion issue, and then you've got right-leaning Christians who are perfectly fine with you know, the ceiling that you know, that a free market puts on the ability of a poor person to advance and move forward in their life and with employment and such. There's not a robust enjoyment of Republican politics by people who are poor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the same way that there's not a robust enjoyment of Democratic politics by people in the womb. And we're just not willing to admit that very often.
Yeah.
And we're not willing to deal with that within our own parties and platforms for fear of losing power. And that's just never been an effective or fruitful way to do life in Christ. And I think we're paying the price for it now.
Yeah, Scott, we only have about 3 minutes left, but I would love for you to tell a story that I heard on your sermon, which I listened to this morning, of a beautiful illustration of love that was between Jerry Falwell and Larry Flint. What an odd couple.
Yeah. Yeah, so you can actually read that story in a masterful book written by my friend John Innazu. He's a professor out at Washington University in St. Louis. It's a book called Confident Pluralism, and he tells that whole story. That's where I first read it. But, yeah, so people who have memory of, you know, the 80s and the 90s might remember how Larry Flint and Jerry Falwell both tried to use the political system to just completely, you know, wreck each other's platforms. And Larry Flint published this, hurtful satire about Jerry Falwell in order to sort of mock him publicly. And Jerry Falwell's people took it to the Supreme Court to and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Larry Flint, you know, with free speech laws and things like that. Bottom line, after that, Jerry Falwell started reaching out privately to Larry Flint, and the two struck up a friendship. They would do visits together with each other. They never reached a point of agreement on, you know, the issues. I mean, how can you when one's committed to pornography and the other's committed to the Bible, you know, as their sort of bottom line in life? But they were able to develop a friendship across the lines of very significant differences. And when Jerry Falwell died, within a few days, Larry Flint publishes this essay, you know, essentially talking about their private friendship and how Jerry Falwell had become very endeared to Larry Flint as a friend and as one who cared for him and loved him. And this is a part of Jerry Falwell that you never see. Like I know a lot of people who've graduated from Liberty University, and, you know, Jerry Falwell's got this, I think, legitimate reputation for making a lot of mistakes behind a microphone and doing more damage than good in his public ministry. But privately, people who knew him at Liberty University will describe him as one of the kindest, most generous, most loving, father-like people they've ever known in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, everybody's a mixed bag, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think those kinds of stories just need to be celebrated more. There's another one where a gay activist is befriended by Dan Cathy, the Christian owner of Chick-fil-A, and that's on Huffington Post, where the gay activist, a guy named Shane Windmeyer, writes about the friendship that that Dan Cathy struck up with him, and it's a really good thing.
So. Scott, thanks so much. I'm going to have to jump. Have a great evening. God bless you.
All
thanks.
All right, good talking to you.
Yep.
All right, bye-bye.
That wraps up our show. Have a great evening. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.